I'll always respect that. I never want to get to the point where I think I'm bigger than that, because that's not the case. What Tori appreciated about Steinbrenner was that the boss was always accessible. He was apt to come blustering into Tori's office at any time, call him on the telephone, or summon him and his other baseball advisors to another emergency meeting in the third-floor executive boardroom of Legends Field. Tori liked knowing that Steinbrenner always was there, and he knew where he stood with him. But that was no longer true in 2007 due to Steinbrenner's health. One of his last true allies, Cashman, would move philosophically further away from him that winter, and Williams had everything to do with it. Williams, 37, was a free agent who wanted to return to the only organization he had ever known. The 22-year-old kid, who had reached the big leagues in 1991 with such a wide-eyed look that teammates derisively called him Bambi, their mistake was taking his naiveness for a competitive softness, had come to win 4 world championship rings, smash 2,336 hits, make 5 All-Star games, win 1 batting title, and earn $103 million. And after all of that, he still gave forth that same youthful naiveness that charmed Yankees fans. Williams was one of their own. They had watched him grow up, deliver in the clutch, and still remain humble, wide-eyed, and sincere. The beauty of Williams was that he hadn't changed much at all, wearing the same uniform and look of blissful earnestness. Before there was Manny being Manny, the catchphrase to excuse the childlike goofiness of Manny Ramirez, there was Bernie being Bernie. After the Yankees beat the Texas Rangers in the clinching Game 4 of the 1996 Division Series, Williams called up Torrey in his hotel room. "I've got a problem," Williams said. "What's that?" Torrey said, expecting the worst. "My family flew out and it costs $500 to change the tickets to go back a day early. Do you know anyone at the airline?" Williams was making $3 million in 1996. Stuff like that made him charming. It really did, Torrey said. Bernie Williams always expected the best. "I'll always remember he made the last out of the 1997 Division Series, a fly ball to center field with a runner on second base, and I had to practically peel him off the steps leading to the clubhouse. I said, 'Bernie, it's not always going to turn out the way you want it to.'" He was devastated. Teammates delighted in Bernie being Bernie. One time he left Yankee Stadium after a night game and forgot his own child, who was playing video games. When he reached home, he realized his oversight and called up Andy Pettit and said, "Andy, can you bring him home?" Another time, after the clinching game of a World Series, Williams drove home without his wife. Waleska Williams was left standing in the waiting room with trainer Steve Donahue. On the last day of the 2005 season, the Yankees went to Fenway Park in Boston, knowing that if they won the game, they would open the Division Series at home against the Angels, and if they lost, they would open against them on the road in Anaheim. Before the game, Williams asked Torrey, "Do you mind if I drive home with my wife after the game?" Said Torrey, "Bernie, if we lose today, we go to Anaheim." Replied Williams, "We do?" Williams would call the Yankee Stadium clubhouse from his home in suburban Westchester at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and, like a little leaguer, say, "It's raining here. Are we playing tonight?" He was known to be late reporting for work from time to time. Williams was late, for instance, for Game 6 of the 2001 World Series and barely arrived in time after his taxi had to negotiate the heavy security measures and barricades set up around the ballpark. There was another time when Torrey walked up to Williams in the lunchroom of the visiting clubhouse in Tampa Bay. Williams was making a sandwich. "How are you doing, Bernie?" Torrey asked. "I missed the bus. I'm sorry for being late," Williams said. "Bernie," Torrey said with a smile, "I didn't even know you were late. But thanks for offering it up. That sandwich is going to cost you $200. Williams laughed. Williams occupied a special place in Yankees history. He had played on a Yankees team that lost 91 games in 1991, and he was there for the reconstruction and the run of a modern dynasty. Williams played in 2006 under a one-year deal for $1.5 million. He was a bargain at that rate, hitting .281 with 12 home runs and 61 runs batted in. He wasn't an everyday player anymore, not even a part-time center fielder, and he and Torrey both knew that. Williams wanted to play another year as a bench player, occasionally starting in the outfield in the event of an injury or a needed day of rest for one of the main outfielders, Damon, Abreu, Cabrera, and Matsui. Soon after the Yankees lost the 2006 ALDS to Detroit, Cashman held a meeting with Torrey and the coaching staff, in which they discussed whether Williams still had a role with the team for 2007. Cashman said that everyone in the room agreed that Williams was done. However, as the Yankees' roster began to take shape over winter, Torrey came to believe that Williams re-emerged as their best option off the bench. Torrey knew that he could still be counted on to give a quality at-bat in a key spot, and who had the added benefit of being a switch hitter, which causes difficult decisions to opposing managers when they try to match up their relief pitchers to gain platoon advantages. Over the previous two seasons, at ages 36 and 37, Williams hit .317 and .321 with runners in scoring position and two outs. Torrey told Cashman he wanted to bring back Williams on a similar deal that he had in 2006. Cashman wanted nothing to do with it. He had a better idea, he said. He pulled out some numbers. He started giving Torrey pinch-hitting numbers and on-base percentage numbers for Josh Phelps and Doug Mankiewicz. That was Cashman's plan. He could do better with a combination of Josh Phelps and Doug Mankiewicz than bringing back Bernie Williams for one more year. Torrey was astounded. "Cash," Torrey said. "Bernie Williams may not play much outfield because we don't have room in the outfield, but as a bench player, a switch hitter? I know if I'm managing in the other dugout and I know they have Bernie Williams sitting there, it's going to affect who I bring in and how I manage the game. If you know the player Bernie was, and he's not that far removed from that, you know that the danger is still there." Cashman stuck to the on-base percentage numbers. "I can't fight that," Torrey said. "For me and some of the other managers, is Mankiewicz coming up to pinch hit going to scare me like Bernie Williams does? Even though he's got a better on-base percentage?" Cashman did not budge. He was also worried about the awkwardness of having to cut an icon like Williams if he showed he was really done. Torrey said, "It was like talking to a brick wall. It never went anywhere." The philosophical battle was no battle at all. Cashman's faith in numbers won out decisively over Torrey's trust in his players. Cashman would not offer Williams a major league contract. He was open to the idea of letting Williams come to camp to try out with a minor league deal. Williams was too proud a Yankee for that. Torrey tried multiple times to talk him into coming to camp as a non-roster invitee. Williams would have none of that scenario. The lack of a real major league offer told Williams all he needed to know. The Yankees had no more use for him. "I talked to him about three or four times," Torrey said, "and I kept trying to convince him to come down, and I did everything but promise him he was going to make the team. I couldn't do that. And I'm not even sure to this day what was going on in Bernie's head. I knew he was hurt by the fact that he was just dismissed. I just think that in Cash's mind they were sort of stuck into paying him for so long, and paying him so much money he felt he owed him nothing, which I'm not sure is the right way to look at things. And then Cash got upset with Bernie, was pissed off at something." In January of 2008, Cashman unwittingly tipped his hand about how he felt about Williams in comments he made at a symposium at William Patterson College in New Jersey, an event Cashman did not figure was destined to hit the newspapers. Cashman took shots at Williams, saying he had a terrible season in 2005, that Torrey played Williams in 2006 ahead of guys who could help us win, and that Williams grew more involved in his music career, and that took away from his play. The Mankiewicz-Phelps plan was, by most any measurement, a bust. Mankiewicz broke his right wrist and played in only 72 games. Williams played at least 119 games in his last 12 seasons after the strike-shortened 1994 season. Phelps was waived in June after playing just 36 games. Combined, Mankiewicz and Phelps batted .200 in all games coming off the bench, with 5 hits and 25 at-bats. "I don't know how many times that year I would look at Don Mattingly and say, 'This is a good spot for Bernie,'" Torrey said. "You've got a pinch-hit opportunity coming up, and they've got a lefty and righty warming up in the bullpen, and with Bernie you neutralize their choices." The Yankees went to 6 World Series under Torrey's, and Williams hit 3rd or 4th in the lineup in every one of them. With his expressive eyes, fluid stroke, and sprinter's body, Williams was not your typical middle-of-the-order slugger on championship teams. He never hit more than 30 home runs. He was, however, more than tough enough to hold down that kind of responsibility. Bernie was a son of a bitch. The pressure of the game never bothered him, Torrey said. It never bothered him. You know, you try to explain all that stuff, and unless you have a feel for what you're seeing, it's tough to rationalize with sheer numbers. I don't think Bernie cared about what it looked like on the field, as opposed to simply what it was. I think good players go on the field knowing there's a danger of being embarrassed, and it doesn't bother them at all. Bernie never thought anything negative was going to happen until it happened. For Torrey, Cashman's dismissal of Williams was also, in part, a repudiation of the manager's trust and understanding of players. The hits to his standing as the secure manager of the New York Yankees were piling up. The sniping via the franchise's own network, and the Cold War with Steinbrenner in 2005, the virtual firing and subsequent twisting in the wind after the 2006 Division Series, and now this, the decision by Cashman to trust a belief in numbers rather than trust Torrey's belief in Bernie Williams. The one that pissed me off more than anything was Bernie Williams, where my opinion was completely disregarded, Torrey said. I was beating a dead horse, and I'll never forget that. The future of Joe Torrey as manager of the New York Yankees was a last-minute addition to the menu at a March 9, 2007 benefit luncheon for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Tampa Bay at the Tampa Marriott Waterside Hotel. The Boys and Girls Clubs of Tampa had long been a favorite charity of George Steinbrenner, and you could find his name affixed to one of its buildings as proof of his generosity. Each spring training, Steinbrenner would make sure his staff and ballplayers joined him in supporting the Boys and Girls Clubs of Tampa Bay by attending the luncheon, which had grown to become one of its largest fundraising events. Brian Cashman decided to use the 2007 luncheon, away from the prying eyes of the New York media, to address the thorny issue of what to do about Torrey, which for the previous 5 months had grown cumbersomely into the elephant in the room nobody wanted to acknowledge. Torrey's status beyond that 2007 season was unresolved. Cashman approached Torrey and asked him, "What do you want to do, Joe?" Torrey immediately recognized the opening. The general manager would not have asked the question if he didn't want Torrey back. That qualified as a major development. Torrey was on the last year of his contract, a status that carried more weight than his 11 consecutive seasons guiding the Yankees into the playoffs, four of which culminated with world championships. The impending end to the deal put him squarely in the crosshairs of his critics, some of whom happened to reside in his own organization. When Torrey had left for spring training, his wife Allie sent him off with a kiss, a hug, and this warning. "This is going to be your toughest year because they're always going to refer to this being the last year of your contract." Said Torrey, "I guess I get naive at times, but I didn't expect it was going to be tougher. That's because I thought you were always on the last year of your contract, no matter what it said. Even if you have a contract, there's always a threat you can be fired." But I never realized how right she really was. Without a contract for 2008, Torrey was a lame duck, made all the more wounded by what amounted to his mock dismissal after the 2006 season, which had played out like being put through every protocol of a firing squad. The blindfold, the cocking of the chambers, the ready-aim-fire command, but for blanks being substituted for bullets. The most important baseball operations decision in the 2007 spring training camp was what to do about Torrey. Cashman opened the door to an extension when he approached Torrey at the March 9th benefit. Cashman wasn't even sure if Torrey had plans to manage beyond 2007. Torrey didn't hesitate with a response. As difficult and painful as the fallout was from the 2006 Division Series loss, Torrey had lost none of his enthusiasm for the job. He hated the interoffice sniping, the jockeying for credit, and the assignment of blame, and he hated knowing not everybody in that front office fully supported him, but Torrey loved managing people and ball games as much as ever. "I'd like to keep managing," Torrey told Cashman. "I still enjoy it." "Okay," Cashman said. "You're my guy. As long as I'm here, there's nobody I'd rather have managing this team than you. How long would you like to do this?" Torrey understood that the door to a contract extension suddenly was jarred open. He was wise enough not to have even broached the subject over the winter after very nearly being fired, but smart enough to know this was the opportunity to get it done. Tori had an idea. "How long do you have on your deal?" Tori asked Cashman. "Through next year." "Okay, just tie me to you. We'll have the same thing. Take it through next year so that we're on the same terms." "That's fine with me," Cashman said. Tori was making $7 million in 2007, the last year of his deal. A one-year extension would, if nothing else, remove his lame duck status and shrink the size of the bullseye on his back. It would minimize the speculation that at any moment he could be fired, a sort of Damocles that can drag down a team, not just the manager. Tori took it as very good news that Cashman wanted to extend him, especially given Cashman's clout in the organization. "When he said that, I'm thinking, it's just a formality," Tori said. "I thought it was a slam dunk. The general manager asks you how long you wanted to manage, and I just assumed..." "Of course, I shouldn't assume anything because he did say, I just want to know what to go to them with." Them. It was a new concept in the Steinbrenner regime. With Steinbrenner no longer robust enough to be the boss, the absolute ruler with absolute power, the Yankees' power structure had devolved into a blurry one that still needed defining. Steinbrenner's sons, Hank and Hal, were in the loop, but not yet fully vested in the daily operations of the club. Trost and Levine steered the business operations of the franchise, but contributed to baseball matters too. One of Steinbrenner's sons-in-law, Felix Lopez, was growing increasingly interested in all aspects of the business of the New York Yankees, completing one of the most astounding rises in corporate American history. Lopez came to the Yankees boardroom by way of landscaping. He met Jessica Steinbrenner, the boss's daughter, while tending to her yard. He married the boss's daughter and immediately became a baseball expert. Another son-in-law, Steve Swindell, was the team's general partner and Steinbrenner's hand-picked successor. Steve Swindell had married the boss's daughter, Jennifer. He ran Bay Transportation Corporation, a marine towing company purchased by Steinbrenner's company, American Shipbuilding. When the Yankees played in Miami against the Marlins in 1997, Steinbrenner asked him if he would like to become a general partner of the Yankees. Swindell loved the idea. He enjoyed the work while by and large tending to keep a low profile. Then one day, June 15th, 2005 to be exact, Swindell was sitting next to George Steinbrenner at a press conference to announce the construction plans and financing for a new Yankee stadium when Steinbrenner blurted out that Swindell, and not either of his own sons, would replace him someday as head of the Yankees. Most everyone in the room was surprised to hear Steinbrenner publicly anoint Swindell as his hand-picked successor. One person was particularly surprised, Swindell himself. Steinbrenner never had told him he was his choice for running the team, never had discussed succession plans with him. "It was news to me," Swindell said. Steve Swindell was the man who would be king of one of the most valuable properties in professional sports, the New York Yankees, which had become an iconic global franchise worth about $2 billion when you folded in the YES Network, the most successful regional sports network in the television industry. Swindell's authority was soon to be completely wiped out by one of the most expensive drinking benders in the history of imbibing. Only 3 weeks and one day prior to Cashman's meeting with Tori, it was Valentine's Day night and the second night of the Yankees' spring training camp, Swindell was driving his 2007 Mercedes in St. Petersburg, at a little past 2 a.m, when he made a hard left turn at the intersection of Central Avenue and 31st Street, cutting off another car. The other vehicle had to brake abruptly to avoid a collision. The other vehicle just so happened to be a police cruiser, driven by Officer Terry Nagel. At that moment, at the corner of Central and 31st, the future operations of the New York Yankees also took an abrupt turn. Nagel followed the Mercedes, which zoomed through the 35-mile-per-hour zone at 61 miles per hour. The officer pulled over the Mercedes some 18 blocks later. It was 2:12 a.m. Swindell failed a field sobriety test. He refused a breathalyzer test. He was arrested for driving under the influence, taken to jail, booked at 4:26 a.m., and released at 9:53 a.m. His police mugshot was soon all over the Internet. The Yankees actually released a statement that said Mr. Swindell apologizes profusely for this distraction during the Yankees' spring training. Distraction? Sure. Driving under the influence is wrong because, well, you don't want it to distract from millionaires taking batting practice and fielding fungos. Despite the comically benign wording, Steve Swindell was soon to be finished with having anything to do with the New York Yankees. He just didn't know it quite yet. About 4 weeks later, Jennifer Swindell filed divorce papers in Hillsborough County Circuit Court's Family Law Department, citing irreconcilable differences that led to the couple splitting on, yes, Valentine's Day. In the filing, Jennifer Swindell asked to keep the couple's $2.3 million home in Tampa's upscale Davis Island neighborhood. Swindell was out of the family, which meant he was out of the Yankees. In between the arrest and the divorce, Swindell continued to show up for work each day at Legends Field, the Yankees' grand but joyless spring training compound that was heavy on concrete, fencing, and stern security officers. He and the Yankees kept up appearances while the lawyers started hammering out divorce papers and severance issues. Swindell remained in the loop on club issues, which meant Cashman would need to run his idea of a contract extension for Torrey past both Swindell and Levine before presenting it to the boss for approval. In times of better health for Steinbrenner, Cashman and Torrey might have dealt directly with Steinbrenner, who then could have chosen to table the idea or give it a green light, perhaps handing it off to one of his lieutenants for negotiation. But with Steinbrenner's vitality in question, so was the usual power structure of the Yankees' front office. That's why Cashman told Torrey he would need to run the idea of an extension past them. A couple of days passed without Cashman giving any word back to Torrey about what he heard back from them. Finally, Torrey decided to ask Cashman what was going on. Torrey had rented a home for spring training, and the owners wanted to know if he would be renting the place again in 2008. "Cash, we just have to make a decision on this place we're renting here," Torrey said. "Do you have any idea about a contract?" "Well, I did talk to Swindell," Cashman offered. "What did he say?" "He said, how much is he going to want?" "Oh, okay." Swindell's response to Cashman was not an encouraging one for Torrey. When Torrey was hired after the 1995 season, the Yankees had not won a playoff series since 1981, the longest drought ever seen at Yankee Stadium since the joint was built back in 1923. They were drawing an average of 23,360 fans per game when Torrey was hired, worse than 14 other franchises, including the Texas Rangers, Cincinnati Reds, and Florida Marlins. But under Torrey, the Yankees had made the playoffs every season and won 17 postseason series, including those four World Series, and the per-game attendance shot up 124% to a major league best 52,445. The Yankees were bankrolling gobs of money because of the demand for season tickets. Nothing better for a club than having tickets sold with cash in hand months before the season even started. And the demand for season tickets was driven by the near certainty that every October the Yankees would be hosting playoff games. From 1996 through 2006, the Yankees played 59 postseason games at Yankee Stadium, two more than were played in the entire 94-year history to that point of Fenway Park in Boston. "What drives season tickets is the expectation of postseason games," said a high-ranking business executive of a National League club. "And to make sure you get those postseason tickets that everybody wants, you have to get your season tickets. The opportunity to see postseason games is the big carrot." Torrey was at the helm during this period of staggering success and wealth for the Yankees. Yet when Cashman broached to Swindell the idea of simply adding 1 year to Torrey's contract, Swindell reacted first not on the merit of the idea, but on the bottom-line cost. Like a piece of bric-a-brac at a garage sale, Torrey's value to the franchise was reduced to a pricing point. This was not a good sign for Torrey. And it was about to get worse. Cashman still needed to run the idea of an extension through Levine before it could get to Steinbrenner. He did so on March 13th, which just happened to be the day after the Yankees lost an exhibition game the previous night to Boston, 7-5. Levine immediately told Cashman to forget about going to the boss at the moment. "I wouldn't go to the boss with it right now," Levine told Cashman, according to what Cashman reported back to Torrey. "Not after the team has lost a couple of games in a row. It's not a good time for this. Tori was incredulous. Not a good time? Tori had won 1,079 games as manager of the Yankees, averaging 98 wins per year, and had won 21 World Series games. No man alive had won more than that. And now Levine was saying that just because the Yankees had lost 2 early spring exhibition games, that they couldn't possibly broach the idea of an extension for Tori with Steinbrenner? How could it be possible that after 11 straight years in the postseason, Tori's future was being judged on 2 meaningless spring training games? How could it be that his worthiness was tied to a game the night before that was so meaningless that the Yankees lineup was packed with players that Steinbrenner himself would not have been able to identify if he ever happened to make one of his old blustery sweeps through the clubhouse, the sweeps he had all but abandoned in his advancing age? How could it be that Torrey's future employment was iced because of a loss with Todd Pratt at catcher, Alberto Gonzalez at shortstop, Chris Bassick at third base, Josh Phelps at first base, and Kevin Reese in right field? How could such a game possibly matter that much? That was it for Tori. The Yankees had told him enough. The mock firing, the hand-wringing over the cost, and now this. His extension considered unspeakable simply because of 2 spring training losses after 11 years on the job. Forget it, Tori told Cashman. What do you mean? Cashman replied. Just forget it, Tori said. Don't even bother asking anymore. I don't want any talk about an extension anymore. Just drop it. And if it does come up, tell them I'll wait until after the season to talk about it. Just forget it for now. I don't want to feel like I'm auditioning for this job. That's the last thing I want to do, to think about that while I'm doing my job. I can't do that. Listen, you guys either like what I do or you think somebody else can do it better. You're not going to hurt my feelings. That's reality. Cashman nodded. I don't want you to have to think about it while you're doing your job, Cashman said. Don't change anything. Just do what you do. There. It was done. The trial balloon of an extension was shot to pieces before it ever got off the ground. The pitfalls of what Allie predicted would be the toughest year of her husband's life were officially put in place. Tori was a confirmed lame duck who, like it or not, was auditioning for the job he had held for 11 years. It was the beginning of the end. 13. We have a problem. Every year, Joe Torre would call a team meeting on the first day of spring training and make sure everyone knew what was expected of them. Win the World Series. No other team in baseball began this way. The speech, of course, also would include the boilerplate stuff about being on time, hustling on the field, and representing the Yankees franchise at all times with class and dignity. But Torre would make sure they also understood the expectations upon them. 29 other teams were hoping for a shot at the playoffs and taking their chances with the random nature of postseason baseball. The Yankees, having once pocketed 4 world championships in 5 years, while winning an odds-defying 12 out of 13 postseason series, had come to believe not just that they should be playing every year in October, but also that they should win the World Series. They adopted the exception as their rule. Each year that passed without the Yankees winning the World Series became a little less joyless, with the incremental successes and highlights of a long season, the kind of season that would have made 29 other franchises proud, lost to the disappointment of not having won it all. Torre got a glimpse of this emptiness at spring training in 2002 while signing autographs one day for a group of fans. "Too bad about last year, Joe," one of them said. "You guys will do better this year." The Yankees had lost the last game of the 2001 World Series on the last pitch of the last inning because of a broken bat bloop hit, and yet the season was a failure. In 2007, you could multiply the disappointment by 6, the number of seasons that had gone by without the Yankees winning the World Series. They were a more pedestrian 5-6 in postseason series in that time. Torre decided he could no longer give his usual spring training speech. Baseball had changed too much. It had become too democratic. 10 different franchises had played in the 6 World Series since the Yankees last won one. Nobody talked about competitive balance problems anymore. The Yankees themselves had changed too much. As Torrey gathered his team in the clubhouse in Tampa for his opening remarks, he saw around the room only four faces who had won a world championship in a Yankees uniform. Derek Jeter, Jorge Posada, Mariano Rivera, and Andy Pettit. Mostly, though, Torrey was tired of hearing the Yankees' accomplishments diminished because the postseason wasn't breaking their way the way it did from 1996 through 2000. The 2006 Yankees had no reason to think they should have been world champions. Jarrett Wright was their number four starter. Aaron Gale and Andy Phillips got more at-bats than Hideki Matsui and Gary Sheffield, who missed chunks of the season with injuries. The Yankees were four games out of first place on the 4th of July. But somehow the Yankees grinded out 97 wins, the most in the American League, and tied with the Mets for the most wins in baseball. All of it, however, was flushed away with the division series loss to Detroit, starting from the moment midway through Game 2 when Messina lost the lead at home. The season was an abject failure because of 3 days in October. Torrey was nearly fired because of it. Torrey decided the speech this year would be different. The goal still was to win the World Series, but he no longer wanted his players to feel the pressure that they were expected to win it. "Look, we're not going to worry about anybody else's perception," Torrey told them. "Go out there and do the best that you can. Prepare yourselves the best that you can and give your very best effort. But don't get caught up in the perceptions and the expectations. Last year we won 97 games. Nobody won more games than us. I refuse to look at that as a failure. You can't always control the outcome. But what you can control is your preparation and how you play. Make sure you take care of preparation and effort. Get to the park every day ready to play, and you basically earn where you wind up." The Yankees had joined the other 29 teams, even if they were the last to admit it. The preponderance of players in the clubhouse had no idea what it was like to win a world championship in Yankee pinstripes, so how could they assume it was their manifest destiny? Besides, on the first day of spring training, Torrey already had some problems on his hands. Three of his starting eight positional players, Bobby Abreu, Jason Giambi, and Johnny Damon, had reported to camp out of shape. And it was about to get worse. Less than 1 week into workouts, General Manager Brian Cashman walked into Torrey's office and said, "We have a problem. Johnny's not sure if he wants to play baseball anymore." Johnny Damon had reported to camp 15 pounds overweight, much of it carried in his midsection. All things considered, he much rather preferred riding his jet ski on the lake right off his backyard in Orlando than getting ready for a baseball season. Damon hadn't bothered to work out that winter, partly, he said, because of a stress fracture in his foot that had not fully healed, but also because he was burned out from baseball. For 11 consecutive years, Damon had played in at least 145 games for four different teams without ever being placed on the disabled list. Even his off-seasons were frazzled. In 2001, for instance, he exercised his free agent rights and left Oakland to sign with the Red Sox. In 2002, he divorced his wife, the mother of his two children, and lived the life of a hard-charging bachelor. Writing in his book Idiot about the 2002 season, Damon said, "If you're good-looking and a ball player, girls want a piece of you. For the rest of the season, I met some women, some good, some bad. I had some one-nighters that I had never gotten to experience before. It was fun. I ended up having to carry around a separate cell phone for the women to call me. I didn't want them to have my main number because my phone would have been ringing off the hook, and it just got tiring." One of the women he met that year, Michelle Mangan, would become his next wife. They were engaged in 2004. That previous off-season, Damon suffered from serious migraines, blurred vision, and post-concussion syndrome, after a violent outfield collision with teammate Damian Jackson in the 2003 playoffs. It literally hurt him to shave, so he didn't, which is how Damon came to acquire the iconic biblical-bearded, long-haired look from what became the 2004 World Championship season of the Boston Red Sox. That winter, while also in demand for personal appearances and endorsements, he and Michelle were married. The next off-season brought another divorce of sorts, as the Red Sox thanked him for his 4 years of service to the team, decided they already had benefited from the best years of his career, and sent him on his free agent way. A disappointed Damon wound up signing a 4-year contract with the Yankees for $52 million. Somehow I became a free agent, and New York was the team that wanted me, he said. The team I ran through walls for didn't even want me, and I was called everything in the book for leaving. I'm just a baseball player. If there was a team in Orlando, Florida, that's the team I would have had the biggest allegiance to. Unfortunately, there's not a baseball team there. Damon gave the Yankees a typically solid season in 2006, including a career-high 24 home runs. As always, he played virtually every day, scored more than 100 runs for the 9th consecutive season, and provided a manic kind of energy and lightness of being that the more serious-minded Yankees sorely needed. I loved his personality, Torrey said. All the fun he had just before the game was great for the team. He always checked with me, even if it was just a glance my way before he did something stupid just for laughs before a game. He might pour water on himself or break a package of sunflower seeds. Anything to relieve the tension. He was great. It all caught up to Damon that winter. His life had been a non-stop string of catastrophes and triumphs. 2 rounds of free agency, divorce, marriage, concussion, the beard, the hair, the first Red Sox World Championship in 86 years. So when the Tigers sent him and the Yankees home to the unusual quiet of that winter, Damon stopped thinking of himself as a baseball player and fell into the welcome comfort of being a stay-at-home dad. He played nearly every day with his 7-year-old twins from his first marriage, while Michelle gave birth in January to the couple's first child, a daughter. After the 06 season, I had a broken bone in my foot, Damon said. So every time I tried to do something physical, running or whatever, I couldn't. There was too much pain. So I didn't do much. Torrey said he didn't know Damon still had problems with his foot, but said, I think it was all connected anyway, not knowing if he wanted to play. He never really got himself in shape for spring training. And if you think about the off-season in today's baseball, unlike when I played, guys use the off-season to get themselves into shape. Actually into better shape than they were the previous season. They work all winter. But if he was in between about playing and not playing, he's not going to be committed to that kind of program. When he got to spring training and said he wasn't sure if he wanted to play, I'm sure that's not the first time it came up. I'm sure he was thinking about it all winter. So in having that thought process, he wasn't doing anything that was going to get himself ready for the season. Damon admitted, every day in the off-season I didn't feel like getting ready for baseball. I was just having fun with the kids, playing on the lake every day. I felt unprepared to make that decision about playing. Damon reported to Tampa for spring training, but his heart wasn't in it. Neither were his legs. His legs had helped make him a star, but being out of shape, Damon couldn't move or run the way he normally did with any kind of explosion. So every time I moved, I felt brittle, he said. And that's where all the leg issues started coming. And for me, that's part of the reason I'm playing baseball. That's why the scouts came out. Watch me run and do that kind of stuff. And when you're not able to do that and track down balls in center field and do that, you start thinking about quitting. I just couldn't see from my perspective going to the ballpark and preparing every day, mentally and physically. I'd been doing it for a long time. I have 3 kids who don't get to see me at my best all the time because I'm constantly thinking about baseball. I'm constantly traveling and my life off the field is so great that I needed a little bit of a break. I knew I still had some baseball in me, but once I started getting these nagging injuries, I started thinking, I don't want to play this game just to be okay. Former Royals infielder Frank White told me one of the best things I heard when he was coaching the outfielders in Kansas City. He said, don't just play the game to play. Try to leave a mark. When I go out there and have a bad game, I feel bad for the fans wearing my jerseys in the stands because I want them to watch me and be impressed. And I didn't feel like I had that going for me. The last straw was knowing that his father's birthday was coming up. Johnny couldn't remember the last time he was with Jimmy Damon on his birthday. Johnny was always playing baseball at spring training somewhere in February. He felt badly about not spending enough time with his father. I wanted to get back to him, Damon said. I don't know how much time he has. I want to spend time with him. I mean, there was just so much going on. My older kids are getting older and bigger. On February 24th, Damon told Cashman he was thinking seriously about quitting baseball. Cashman quickly arranged a meeting with Damon, Torrey, and the team psychologist in Torrey's office. Torrey suggested they move somewhere else, knowing that any time reporters noticed the door to his office closed, a vigil would begin to see who would come out when the door opened. So the four of them moved the meeting to the trainer's room, in a back portion of the clubhouse not accessible to reporters. Johnny was apologetic and I felt bad for him, Torrey said. Of course, Cashman's mind worked in a different way. It was more like, if you're going to retire, this is how much money we have to work with, this is what you're leaving on the table. And we basically didn't try to talk him out of anything. We just said, take what time you need. And we're not going to lie to the media. We're just going to say you had to deal with some personal matters, and whenever you come back, you come back. Damon jumped in his car and drove home to Orlando. He played with his kids and took his father out to dinner to celebrate his birthday. Who knew how long he would stay away from baseball? A day? A week? Forever? His dinner with Jimmy actually convinced him he needed to get back to baseball, at least for the time being anyway. Jimmy told him life after baseball would always be there for him, but for now baseball afforded him a national platform to affect people's lives. Damon, for instance, helps raise awareness and funds for the Wounded Warriors Project, a charity that assists soldiers injured in battle to transition into civilian life. Being a baseball player, especially a Yankee, Jimmy told him, made his contribution to that kind of work much more impactful. On the third day of his sabbatical, Johnny Damon drove back to Tampa and became a baseball player again. I just found out the importance of going to play baseball again, Damon said. What it came down to was coming back wasn't for me. It was for the Yankees. The Yankees were the reason I wanted to go play again. They showed faith in me and gave me a real nice contract. And there's a lot of fans out there who like what I do, and a lot of charities out there I can help by being a ball player. I'm thinking about baseball now, but I'm also thinking about life after baseball. There are so many people I can impact, and baseball gives me that avenue to do it. It wasn't so simple, however. It would be months before Damon was fully vested in playing baseball again, months in which the Yankees' season staggered and swooned. At the same time, Abreu and Giambi were also out of shape and unproductive. On the same day Damon returned to camp, Abreu strained an oblique muscle while taking batting practice. Giambi hadn't done any running all winter, restricting his workouts to weight training and cardio machines. His legs, back, and hips had pained him too much to do any running, the result, he would later discover, of having unusually high arches in his feet. The Yankees, quite literally, began the year in bad shape. Torrey had another issue to consider that spring. Should he bend his team rules to accommodate the possible signing of Roger Clemens? Clemens visited the Yankees at Legends Field on March 7th, still coy about whether he was going to come out of retirement a third time or not. The Yankees understood, however, that bringing in Clemens meant allowing him the same privileges that the Houston Astros had granted him the previous 3 years. The Astros permitted Clemens to leave the team between his starts whenever he wished. So if Clemens wanted to watch his son Kobe play minor league baseball or caddy for his wife Debbie at their local golf club championship, he was free to ditch his teammates. Clemens wasn't interested in giving up such a privilege to return to baseball. Torrey had allowed players to leave the team in the past, but only starting pitchers between starts, and only then with work-related issues, such as the medical treatments Kevin Brown needed for his back. I turned down a lot of regular players who wanted to go to graduations and things, and I couldn't let them go, Torrey said. Wade Boggs asked me once and I told him no. You can't make a case for regular players. Torrey considered relief pitchers also as too necessary to allow them to take leaves of absence. Indeed, during that 2007 season, in June, closer Mariano Rivera asked Torrey for permission to skip the Yankees series in Colorado to attend his child's school graduation. Torrey told him no, that the Yankees could not afford to let him go. I'm sorry, Rivera told Torrey, but I'm going to go whether I have permission or not. Listen, Torrey said. I can't stop you from going, but if it comes to the eighth or ninth inning and we have a lead and we need you and you're not there, what do I say to people? You tell me what I'm supposed to say. Say you're gone without permission? Do you want to deal with that kind of shit? I don't know what you want me to say, but I can't tell people I gave you permission when there are 24 other guys counting on you. I can't do that. Rivera understood. He did not leave. and the Yankees were swept 3 games by the Rockies. Rivera wasn't needed at all. As a starting pitcher, Clemens was different. He wasn't needed in the 4 games between starts. Still, Torrey would have to decide if his disappearances would cause resentment or adversity within the team. At least Gary Sheffield and Randy Johnson, each traded after the 2006 season, were not still around. Torrey figured both Sheffield and Johnson, both of whom were established stars given to moodiness, might have had trouble with the Yankees granting a privilege to Clemens that had not been extended to them. The Clemens family plan might have caused problems in a clubhouse with Sheffield and Johnson in it, Torrey thought. Cash felt the same way, and it was for probably the same reasons, Torrey said. To find out whether it still might cause resentment with the 2007 Yankees, Torrey talked to some of his star players. Cashman told me in spring training we had a shot at Roger, and this was going to be a part of his deal, Torrey said. It was part of the rules. If you wanted to get him, it was part of the package. To be honest, when it was presented to me, I first thought, I can't have that with this team. So when I got the heads up then that he might be coming, I mentioned it to Jeter and Jason and Alex. I talked to them individually and casually, behind the batting cage. I said, I've got to know, is this going to bother anybody? And everybody said, as long as he wins ball games, we don't give a shit about what he does. No one had a problem with it. A lot of it depends on the makeup of your team. The comparison to me is when Richie Allen was coming from Philadelphia to the Cardinals when I was playing with the Cardinals. And we had stars like Bob Gibson and Lou Brock. Richie would show up late, but we would protect his ass and nobody would know it. But then Richie was with the Dodgers and it was totally different. Richie would show up late there and players would be waiting for him to show up in the parking lot just so they could show up after him. So it depends on the makeup of your team. I just had a feeling that Roger wasn't going to be running home all the time and abusing the privilege. I said to Cash, I don't think it will be an issue, but we'll accept whatever it is. My thinking is you have to see how it affects other people and allow certain things because of that. I may be off base. That's just the way I feel, knowing the personality of a team, knowing what's real and what's made up. Of course, Clemens didn't know it yet, but he had far bigger problems than securing a season's worth of hall passes from the Yankees. 3 months earlier, federal agents had raided the Long Island, New York home of Kurt Radomski, a former Mets clubhouse attendant who for more than a decade had provided performance-enhancing drugs to baseball players. The agents discovered personal checks and phone records linked to Brian McNamee, the personal trainer of Clemens. It was only a matter of time before Clemens' career and his life would blow up into a complete mess. The Yankees knew they would need Clemens, even with the right-hander turning 45 that season. They went to spring training having committed 2 of the 5 spots in the starting rotation to Carl Pavano, who had not pitched in the big leagues since midway through the 2005 season because of a series of ailments, and Kei Igawa, a left-hander whom the Yankees acquired as a posted free agent from Japan at the cost of $46 million, including a $26 million posting fee that stunned everybody else in baseball. Igawa inspired almost no confidence in his own clubhouse. Even before the Yankees were announced as having placed the winning bid in the posting process, an American League general manager, asked about how Igawa might fare in the major leagues, said, "He better stay out of the American League. Maybe if you put him in the NL West with the pitcher batting and the bigger ballparks in that division, you might get by with him as a 4th or 5th starter. But he can't pitch in the American League. We had no interest in him." The Yankees fell in love with Igawa, valuing him higher than anybody else. Not coincidentally, the Yankees turned in their bid on Igawa soon after losing the posting process for Daisuke Matsuzaka, another posted free agent from Japan. The Boston Red Sox blew away the field with a posting fee of $51.1 million for Matsuzaka, who was considered one of the best pitchers in the world. The Yankees had bid slightly more than $30 million for Matsuzaka. How was it possible that they could bid nearly the same amount for Igawa, who, though a strikeout champion in Japan, gave up too many home runs and walks, rarely broke 90 miles an hour with his fastball, and did not own a single impressive outpitch? Well, they made sure they weren't going to go 0-for-2 in the posting process. Igawa was all theirs. Meanwhile, free agent pitcher Ted Lilly was hoping the Yankees would sign him. Lilly had cried the day in 2002 when Cashman traded him to Oakland, in a three-way deal in which the Yankees wound up with Jeff Weaver, who turned out to be the worst of the three pitchers traded. Detroit obtained Jeremy Bonderman, who had helped beat the Yankees on the Tigers' way to the 2006 pennant. Lilly fit the profile of a classic Yankee contributor, a left-handed pitcher who thrived in the pressure of New York and the AL East. He wanted to be a Yankee. Lilly had just won 15 games for the Toronto Blue Jays. He had no major arm issues. Cashman didn't want Lilly. He preferred Egawa, though Egawa would cost the Yankees more money over 4 years, $46 million, including the $26 million posting fee, than what Lilly would cost on the free agent market, $40 million, with the Cubs winning his services. Cashman told Torrey, "Egawa's as good as Lilly, and he won't cost us as much," because the posting fee did not count toward the Yankees' official payroll, thus rendering it tax-free money as far as their luxury tax bill was concerned. As soon as Cash said that, Egawa was as good as Lilly. "That was good enough for me," Torrey said. Egawa was no sure thing, and even the Yankees knew it. When the Yankees introduced Egawa at a news conference after his signing, Cashman did as much as he could to lower expectations for his $46 million man. "We're trying to be very careful and respectful of the process, and not put too much on his shoulders," Cashman said then. "He seems like a tough kid, and he's obviously pitched in front of big crowds for a very successful organization. At the same time, there's going to be a lot of new experiences for him here in the States and in this league. We'll have to wait and see what we get." The Yankees had passed on Lilly as well as Gil Mesh, another free agent, and traded Randy Johnson so they could commit two spots in their rotation to Pavano and Egawa. Worse, there was little insurance behind them. None of it proven. The Yankees had people such as Daryl Rasner, Matt DeSalvo, Jeff Karstens, and Chase Wright behind them, all of them underwhelming. Phil Hughes was the crown jewel of the farm system, but he was only 20 years old. The Yankees had placed high-risk bets that Pavano could stay healthy and that Egawa could get major league hitters out, and it was apparent extremely quickly that both bets were losing propositions. In the case of Egawa, it took only one day to figure out he was a bust. Bullpen catcher Mike Borzella was assigned to catch Egawa's first throwing session in spring training. Borzella was looking forward to it, especially after Billy Epler, the assistant to Cashman, had raved about Egawa to Borzella. "Did you catch Egawa yet?" Epler asked excitedly. "No," Borzella replied. "Just wait," Epler said. "He's got a nasty changeup. You'll see." Egawa threw to Borzella at Legends Field. Borzella could not believe this was the same guy Epler was talking about, the same guy to whom the Yankees gave $46 million, and the same guy the Yankees wanted instead of Lilly. "I caught Kei Egawa," Borzella said. "It was awful. He maybe threw 3 strikes out of 25 pitches. The changeup was horrible. I was reaching all over the place for his pitches." Epler saw Borzella after the throwing session that day. "So, what do you think of Egawa?" Epler asked. "The truth?" Borzello said. "Yeah. He threw 3 strikes the whole time. His changeup goes about 40 feet. His slider is not a big league pitch. His command was terrible." Epler was stunned. "I'll tell you this," Borzello continued. "I hope he's hurt, so there's an explanation for throwing like that." "Oh, really?" Epler said. "Really," Borzello said. "He was terrible." Egawa would never get any better. "His command was a big problem," Torrey said. "He could never throw 2 pitches in a row to the same spot, even in a bullpen session. He would miss and miss badly with his location consistently." Borzello said the investment in a pitcher like Egawa caught the attention of the players in the clubhouse, who had once known the Yankees to be the big game hunters of the pitching market, having acquired such talents as Jimmy Key, Orlando Hernandez, David Wells, David Cone, and Clemens over the years. "You're talking about a guy pitching for the New York Yankees," Borzello said. "The New York Yankees always went after the premier guys. And after investing $200 million in payroll, why are you putting the ball in the hands of this kind of pitcher? It made no sense." But the Yankees kept making the same mistake. Pavano, Jarrett Wright, Egawa. Other organizations scrape up that kind of pitching. But the Yankees? These were the 2007 Yankees, the team on which Torrey, in the last year of his contract, would be placing his managerial future. 40% of the rotation was assigned to Bovano, who couldn't stay healthy, and Egawa, who couldn't throw a strike. Bovano, because of injuries to the other starters, was the Yankees' opening day pitcher. The center fielder Damon wanted to quit. The right fielder Abreu was hurt and out of shape. The first baseman Giambi was too out of shape to play first base anymore, so he had to be the designated hitter, while the first base position was an open casting call among Doug Mankiewicz, Josh Phelps, and Andy Phillips, none of whom could hit as a first baseman should. The biggest acquisition to come, Clemens, was turning 45, and had successfully lobbied for special treatment. Did this look like a team that should be expected to win the World Series? And did Torrey have any loyalists left in the front office, after being embarrassed in the public stocks after the 2006 Division Series? In the clubhouse and on the field, these were no longer the Yankees as the baseball world knew them. They wore the same pinstripes, played in the same ballpark, claimed ownership to the same 26 World Series titles, but these Yankees were no longer the same Yankees who could regard the World Series as a virtual birthright. Most obvious of all, these were no longer George Steinbrenner's Yankees. The boss had imposed his will and spirit upon the entire organization and the Yankees, and were the better and the worse for it all these years. Now there was a vacuum where there had been so much energy. For Torrey, Steinbrenner's decline was another blow to the underpinnings of his management. Steinbrenner could be demanding and unreasonable, but Torrey could always speak to him, and usually find the right words to keep the boss from completely blowing a fuse. In 2007, the pipeline was cut. Torrey knew it, especially when he would be leaving Legends Field in the early evening after a full day of work and see Steinbrenner only then coming to work himself. On the last day of spring training, it was obvious that Steinbrenner was too frail to be the boss. Torrey rode the elevator at Legends Field to the fourth floor to say goodbye to Steinbrenner. The Yankees were preparing to fly from Tampa to New York to begin the season in 2 days. The team would hold its annual welcome home dinner on the eve of the opener. Steinbrenner sat in the suite adjacent to his office. Hank Steinbrenner was there. Felix Lopez was there. Steinbrenner's wife, Joan, was there. "Boss, I'm just here to say goodbye," Torrey said. "Okay," Steinbrenner said. "I'll see you tomorrow night." Joan looked at Torrey, and as they moved away from Steinbrenner and toward the door, she told him with a concerned look on her face, "I don't know how we're going to get him there." They did get Steinbrenner to New York for the dinner, in what stood as a rare trip for him then. Torrey saw Steinbrenner at the dinner and walked across the room to greet him. Steinbrenner was sitting with his family. He looked frail. He was wearing dark glasses in the ballroom, and even beneath those dark glasses, as Torrey could see, Steinbrenner was crying. He was choked up, hit by another emotional jag at what was supposed to be the birthplace of optimism and sunshine, opening day eve. As Steinbrenner dabbed at a melancholy tear, Torrey knew life with the Yankees would never be the same for both of them. The second game of the 2007 season was rained out, which was not a bad development for the Yankees. It kept them undefeated for one more day and postponed the hellish spring about to come their way. Alex Rodriguez peeled off his uniform and reassumed his proper East Side look, a green cable-knit sweater pulled over a black turtleneck, jeans and sneakers. His goal for the season was to be completely inoffensive, or, as third base coach Larry Boa constantly would remind him, vanilla. Rodriguez was off to a good start, the green sweater and a March interview with New York AM radio station WFAN notwithstanding. Rodriguez said on air that whether he stayed with the Yankees or used an opt-out clause in his contract to leave for another team after the season would be decided by whether New York fans accepted him or not. "It's a do-or-die situation," he said. "He's night and day from where he was last year," Boa said as the regular season began. "You could see it in him when spring training started. Everything he's doing is just natural. He's just letting his ability take over. I'm not going to use the word relaxed because he's still intense. But there's a different look about him. He's not worried about everything that's going on around him. Vanilla. We use that word a lot when we talk. Simple. Keep it plain. I only had to get on him once. It was a couple of days after he went on WFAN. and I gave it to him pretty good. I told him, "Why do you have to keep saying this stupid shit?" Boa was an important part of Torrey's management of the team. Players respected him because he had the substantial big-league resume few coaches have in the modern game. Boa played 16 years in the major leagues, collected 2,191 hits, won two gold gloves at shortstop, finished as high as third in Most Valuable Player Award voting, and was selected to 5 All-Star games, and won a world championship with the 1980 Phillies. His fiery temperament, colorful vocabulary, and reactionary nature made him a volatile manager with the Padres and Phillies, but as a coach he established himself as one of the best in the business. A hard-working student of the game who, most importantly, kept players from getting too comfortable. His in-your-face manner was a nice compliment to the relaxed style of Torrey, and it seemed to be exactly what not only A-Rod needed, but also a young player like second baseman Robinson Cano, who knew he could be a good major leaguer strictly on his talent, but didn't know the work it would require to be a great major leaguer. One day in April, talking about Cano, Boa said, "He backhanded a ball the other day, an easy two-hopper he should have gotten in front of. He had a bat at bat right before that. I'm convinced he took his at-bat out into the field with him. You have to stay on, Robbie. Like out in Oakland. There was a relay and he just assumed Eric Chavez was going to stop at second base. He didn't. That's Robbie's fault. You have to assume the runner is going to continue, and then if you turn and see he's stopped, then you can relax. But he did the exact opposite. He just assumed Chavez wasn't going. That's a lazy mistake. I got on him pretty good about that. Just like today, too. He said to me, 'No ground balls, I'm just going to hit in the cage.'" The Yankees that day offered only optional hitting in the indoor batting cage. There was no usual pregame hitting on the field, during which Boa always made sure to hit Cano ground balls. "And I tell him, 'No, you're not,'" Boa said. "You're not just going to the cage, you're going to get your ass out here and work. You're 23 years old, not some old veteran who needs a break. See, the thing is, you have to remind yourself that he's 23. You have to get on him, but then you ask yourself, who at the age of 23 has it all figured out? But you look at him, and you see that he can be as good as he wants to be, as great as he wants to be. He's that talented. He glides into the ball, but unlike most guys who do that, he keeps his hands back. And then when he brings the bat through, it stays through the strike zone for a very long time. He's like George Brett that way. He can be as great as he wants to be." Cano, of course, took his ground balls that day. With Boa riding him, Cano would hit 306 in 2007, with 97 runs batted in. Like Cano, Rodriguez knew Boa was always there to push him. In spring training, for instance, Boa berated Rodriguez for making soft, lazy throws to second base on the front end of double plays. "You're going to get your second baseman killed," Boa told him, and ordered Rodriguez to work on the throws early in the morning on a backfield before most of his teammates had even showed up. The gruff Boa was an important voice to someone like Rodriguez, who otherwise surrounded himself with a cadre of publicity agents and buddies who amounted to a backslapping club. "You know, the big thing with these guys, they might not tell you they like it, but the real good players, they don't want to hear just that you agree with them," Boa said. "I mean, if it happened once, it happened 10 times in 2 years with Alex. Alex would come up to me after making a mistake and say, 'Do you think I should have had that ball?' And 9 times out of 10 he makes that play. And I said, 'Yeah, you've got to catch that ball.' After it happened 4 or 5 times, I told him, 'Al, every time you come to me, you know you should have made the play, or you wouldn't have come to me. I've seen you make mistakes on a line drive, backhand. You don't come to me because you know it's a tough play. But every play you think you should make, you come to me. So I'm just going to reaffirm that I know you should have made that play. And I think the players like when you're being honest. They might not like it at the time, but they like you to be upfront with them." Rodriguez, however, already carried one of the highest capacities for work in baseball. The most important push he received from Boa was not to work, but to keep himself out of trouble. Rodriguez made an obvious effort to do just that in 2007. The goal, as Boa would say, was to prevent himself from saying stupid shit. The Yankees had won nothing more than a division series matchup against Minnesota since they acquired Rodriguez, who had become, because of his talent, because of his industry-rattling $252 million contract that remained unsurpassed 6 years running, and because of his knack for calling attention to himself, not always for the better, the embodiment of Yankee failures. Much of it was unfair, of course, not unlike the prettiest girl in high school becoming an easy target for criticism. Torrey knew that, and wanted Rodriguez to know he shouldn't fight it. One day in March, just before the Yankees were to play a spring training game, Torrey pulled Rodriguez aside near the dugout. "Look, a lot of what goes on with you is unfair," Torrey told Rodriguez. "You're the story no matter what happens, if you get four hits or no hits, if we win or if we lose. I understand that. But you can't worry about that. What you've got to do is just play and not worry about what's going to happen. Just let it happen instead of worrying about the consequences." Opening day could not have begun much worse for A-Rod. He dropped the first ball hit to him, a foul pop-up. Batting cleanup, his first game since Torrey batted him eighth in the division series clinching defeat to Detroit, Rodriguez struck out with two runners on. It was only the first inning of the first game of the season, and he was getting booed. But Rodriguez turned his day and the game around. With the game tied at five, Rodriguez began the seventh inning with a single off Tampa Bay pitcher Brian Stokes. Running on his own, he stole second base and scored the tie-breaking run on a single by Jason Giambi. The stolen base reflected how Rodriguez had changed his body over the winter, dropping 15 pounds without losing strength, and reducing his body fat from 18% to 10%, an astounding four-month transformation for someone turning 32 years old that summer. Asked the next night after the rainout if he would have attempted a steal in the same situation the previous season, Rodriguez said, "Last year? No way. Because I would have been out by 2 feet. That wasn't part of my game. I knew I wanted to go early in the count. I waited one pitch. I wanted to see if he would slide step and just to get a look at him. But I wanted to be aggressive. The big thing is making sure you take the double play out of order. It's the situation, more so than the pitcher there." Rodriguez is a unique talent, a guy who could break